Perhaps it'd be interesting just to think back to why this meeting was organised, or perhaps why any particular meeting of the BSA Race and Ethnicity Group was organised. I've been retired for some years now, and I was kind of watching the emails and the websites and looking at what was going on in the field of the sociology of race relations. Because one of the great things about being retired is you can actually get back to serious academic work. And I was very struck by, and this may be very selective vision on my part, so don't be offended if I tread on any toes in saying this, but I was very struck by what seemed to be an awful lot of meetings and discussions and papers in the field of what I would call race relations, which were on culture and identity, a lot about identity politics, and some of it about incredibly boring things like football. And as I say, that may be my selective viewing of what was going on in the field. And in preparing for today's meeting, I'm coming a bit more round to that view, that it was my selectivity. But it did seem to me that what was going on wasn't addressing the key institutions of domination and inequality, global issues of migration, or the politics of border controls. Now, of course, there are specific and specialist academic institutions that are dealing with these issues in very important ways, and some of those institutions are represented here today. But I didn't get the feeling that this was sort of in the mainstream of sociology. My impression was that there was an awful lot about identity and not much about domination. So it seemed to me, anyhow, that we weren't engaging as well as we should be with public issues and social policy as sociologists of race relations. Anyhow, I hope that one of the recurrent themes that we discuss today will not be the older generation complaining about the younger. But while I am in complaining mode, I might perhaps mention the problem that many colleagues in sociology, and perhaps many of you, encounter, and maybe colleagues in other social science disciplines encounter as well, which is in persuading students of the importance of evidence. There's certainly a significant minority of sociology students, I don't know about other disciplines, for whom doing sociology is seen as an opportunity to express opinions, and then some feeble and unconvincing theories may be advanced to suggest that all opinions are equally valid. Now, the work we are discussing today shows the importance of careful engagement with evidence, data. And whether some of our students, or indeed some of our colleagues, like it or not, statistics. So I do hope that one recurrent theme that will underpin today's discussions will be the challenge of data to theory and theory to data. I've always found, kind of being somebody who's done a lot of work in the field as a sociologist, that almost every encounter with data sets me off theorising. And as soon as I start thinking about theory, I want more data. And I hope that kind of interchange will be represented today. But let's return to the substantive issues. whether or not we're addressing the questions that we ought to be addressing in a serious and effective sociology of, for want of a better term, race relations, I think we can be quite sure that whatever we say will be ignored. The only question is the extent to which it will be ignored. Governments on the whole are not entirely evidence averse, but they are very selective in their use of evidence. And I think colleagues working in education, health, poverty studies, and criminal justice will all have their own stories to tell of evidence cherry-picked and data ignored. So there are plenty of seats. And sometimes attempts are actually made to shut us up. And I suppose one of the most conspicuous recent examples of this is in the case of Alison Pollock and her colleagues, who've done very interesting and important research on the effectiveness of PFI. And those of you who followed the press accounts will know that efforts were made to, shall we say, suppress. But I think in the field of race and immigration, it's safe to say that we are totally ignored. And this is not a complaint. That research, evidence is ignored, is itself just data. So I think many of us here today will be especially interested to see what response, if any, there is to the book whose findings we will be discussing. Now, Ludi will be speaking about the parallel lives debate, but I do think it's quite important to see how this too has been a recurrent theme for many years. Most recently, the parallel lives debate was about the lives lived by the underclass, a section of the population living lives apart in dysfunctional families or single mother households, work shy and raising a generation of young delinquents, or according to Paul Bagley's critique, idle thieving bastards. But paupers, the residuum, and the various manifestations of the undeserving poor, described by Kirk Mann in his 1992 book, The Making of an English Underclass, have always been on the political agenda, always menacing, always needing surveillance and control, policing. And then there were the degenerate classes, variously reputed to be an alarmingly high percentage of the populations of the USA, Britain, and Germany, who were the targets of eugenicists at the beginning of the 20th century and of the Nazis in the mid-century. And paradoxically, some of the techniques used to trace, document, and analyse the unworthy and dangerous elements, and perhaps to identify them for forced sterilisation or worse, have become part of the everyday techniques used by social researchers. A number of important statistical tests were developed by eugenicists. All of you who have ever used Pearson's product moment correlation, all right? Pearson, University College London, a prime eugenicist. And we can continue this theme back even further, thinking of a book I'm just reading at the moment. We can see that from the late 16th to the early 19th century, Roman Catholics in Britain were the Muslims of their day. You know, they all potential subversives, representing the interests of a foreign state, you know, given to acts of terrorism. the most conspicuous and unsuccessful one of which was to blow up the Houses of Parliament. So this notion of there being this set of people living dangerous parallel lives is not entirely new. And the fact that recent careful research has shown that the underclass was not a fixed population and that members strove to escape it and felt demeaned and devalued by the benefits regime did not prevent the term passing into common usage and being applied to almost any group that politicians or the popular press wished to abuse. I've got a list somewhere in about sort of 14 different, quite separate categories of people who have been referred to as the underclass. The term and its suggestion of menace and threat provided a convenient backdrop to the creation of a harsher and meaner welfare state. And the parallel lives and self-segregation propositions passed equally quickly into public discourse and are now firmly embedded in policy proposals. Most notably, I think, the social cohesion agenda. The president of the British Psychological Association recently asked at our annual conference what it would be like if there was no sociology. I commend the social cohesion policies developed in England and in Wales of examples of what a world without sociology would look like. The intellectual incoherence and general confusion of these documents almost beggars belief. Probably explains why the Welsh Assembly seemed to attempt to have secret consultations on their document. I think it would have been far better for governments to have issued documents saying, we want people to get on and be nice to one another, than to have produced muddled and internally contradictory strategies for something called social cohesion. Now, Flint and Robinson, in their book also produced by the Policy Press, although it's not actually on sale today, and I gather you can order it here, Community Cohesion in Crisis, to which Ludy Simpson himself contributed, have begun a critique of which today's discussion will also be a part. And I think that critique can be read alongside a number of other recent publications, Wilkinson and Pickett's book, The Spirit Level, and perhaps Toynbee and Walker's book, Unjust Rewards. But let me just finish by emphasising the self-evident, if you like, which is the racialised nature of the current policy discourse. Not only is it ethnic minorities who are seen to be living lives apart, or said to be living lives apart, they're also apparently seen to constitute the seedbed of terrorism in support of our enemies abroad, just like the Catholics in earlier years. And the diverse cultures of these minorities are no longer a cause for celebration, but a problem that must be addressed by persuasion and coercion. Integration and assimilation, echoes of themes from the USA and the UK in the 1960s, are back on the agenda. And furthermore, whilst we are urged to promote a singularly ill-defined social cohesion, we are also invited to spy on those with whom we should be cohering. But underpinning these strategies, there is the now taken for granted assumption about parallel lives and sleepwalking to segregation. And it is Sleepwalking to Segregation. That is the title and topic of Ludy Simpson's book, and on which he is now going to address us all. So with those words of introduction, Ludy Simpson.